miracles can I work? I can work the miracle of predicting, with absolute accuracy, the things that the future will bring.
Rumford thereupon predicted 50 future events in great detail. These predictions were carefully recorded by those present. Needless to say, they all came true eventually, came true in great detail.
"The teachings of this religion will seem subtle and confusing at first," said Rumford, "but they will become beautiful and crystal clear as time goes by." "As a presently confusing beginning," said Rumford, "I shall tell you a parable. Once upon a time, luck arranged things so that a baby named Malachi Constant was born the richest child on earth. On the same day, luck arranged things so that a blind grandmother stepped on a roller skate at the head of a flight of cement stairs. A policeman's horse stepped on an organ grinder's monkey, and a paroled bank robber found a postage stamp worth $900 in the bottom of a trunk in his attic. I ask you, is luck the hand of God?"
Rumford held up an index finger that was as translucent as a Limoges teacup.
"During my next visit with you, fellow believers," he said, "I shall tell you a parable about people who do things that they think God Almighty wants done. In the meanwhile, you would do well, for background on this parable, to read everything that you can lay your hands on about the Spanish Inquisition. The next time I come to you," said Rumford, "I shall bring you a Bible, revised so as to be meaningful in modern times. And I shall bring you a short history of Mars, a true history of the saints who died in order that the world might be united as the brotherhood of man. This history will break the heart of every human being who has a heart that can be broken."
Rumford and his dog dematerialized abruptly. On the spaceship out of Mars and bound for Mercury, on the spaceship carrying Unk and Boaz, the automatic pilot navigator decreed that it be day in the cabin again. It was the dawn following the night in which Unk had told Boaz that the thing in Boaz's pocket couldn't hurt anybody anymore. Unk was asleep on his bunk in a sitting position. His Mauser rifle, loaded and cocked, lay across his knees. Boaz was not asleep. He was lying on his bunk across the cabin from Unk. Boaz had not slept a wink. He could now, if he wanted to, disarm and kill Unk easily. But Boaz had decided that he needed a buddy far more than he needed a means of making people do exactly what he wanted them to. During the night, he'd become very unsure of what he wanted people to do anyway. Not to be lonely, not to be scared. Boaz had decided that those were the important things in life. A real buddy could help more than anything. The cabin was filled with a strange, rustling, coughing sound. It was laughter. It was Boaz's laughter. What made it so strange was that Boaz had never laughed in that particular way before. Had never laughed before at the things he was laughing at now. He was laughing at the ferocious mess he was in, at the way he had pretended all his army life that he had understood everything that was going on, and that everything that was going on was just fine. He was laughing at the dumb way he had let himself be used by God knows who for God knows what.
"Holy smokes, buddy," he said out loud. "What we doing way out here in space? What we doing in these here clothes? Who's steering this fool thing? How come we climbed into this tin can? How come we got to shoot somebody when we get to where we're going? How come he got to try and shoot us? How come?"
said Boaz.
"Buddy," he said, "you tell me how come."
Unk woke up, swung the muzzle of his Mauser around to Boaz. Boaz went right on laughing. He took the control box out of his pocket, and he threw it on the floor.
I don't want it, buddy, he said. That's okay you went and tore its insides out. I don't want it.
And then he yelled,
I don't want none of this crap!
Chapter 8 In a Hollywood Nightclub. Harmonium. The only known life form on the planet Mercury. The Harmonium is a cave dweller. A more gracious creature would be hard to imagine. A child's cyclopedia of wonders and things to do. The planet Mercury sings like a crystal goblet. It sings all the time. One side of Mercury faces the sun. That side has always faced the sun. That side is a sea of white hot dust. The other side faces the nothingness of space eternal. That side has always faced the nothingness of space eternal. That side is a forest of giant blue-white crystals, aching cold. It is the tension between the hot hemisphere of day without end and the cold hemisphere of night without end that makes Mercury sing. Mercury has no atmosphere. So the song it sings is for the sense of touch. The song is a slow one. Mercury will hold a single note in the song for as long as an earthly millennium. There are those who think that the song was quick, wild, and brilliant once. Excruciatingly various. Possibly so. There are creatures in the deep caves of Mercury. The song their planet sings is important to them. For the creatures are nourished by vibrations. They feed on mechanical energy. The creatures cling to the singing walls of their caves. In that way, they eat the song of Mercury. The caves of Mercury are cozily warm in their depths. The walls of the caves in their depths are phosphorescent. They give off a jonquil yellow light. The creatures in the caves are translucent. When they cling to the walls, the light from the phosphorescent walls comes right through them. The yellow light from the walls, however, is turned when it passes through the bodies of the creatures to a vivid aquamarine. Nature is a wonderful thing. The creatures in the caves look very much like small, spineless kites. They are diamond-shaped, a foot high and 8 inches wide when fully mature. They have no more thickness than the skin of a toy balloon. Each creature has 4 feeble suction cups, one at each of its corners. These cups enable it to creep, something like a measuring worm, and to cling, and to feel out the places where the song of Mercury is best. Having found a place that promises a good meal, the creatures lay themselves against the wall like wet wallpaper. There is no need for a circulatory system in the creatures. They are so thin that life-giving vibrations can make all their cells tingle without intermediaries. The creatures do not excrete. The creatures reproduce by flaking. The young, when shed by a parent, are indistinguishable from dandruff. There is only one sex. Every creature simply sheds flakes of his own kind, and his own kind is like everybody else's kind. There is no childhood as such. Flakes begin flaking 3 earthling hours after they themselves have been shed. They do not reach maturity, then deteriorate and die. They reach maturity and stay in full bloom, so to speak, for as long as Mercury cares to sing. There is no way in which one creature can harm another, and no motive for one's harming another. Hunger, envy, ambition, fear, indignation, religion, and sexual lust are irrelevant and unknown. The creatures have only one sense: touch. They have weak powers of telepathy. The messages they are capable of transmitting and receiving are almost as monotonous as the song of Mercury. They have only 2 possible messages. The first is an automatic response to the second, and the second is an automatic response to the first. The first is, here I am, here I am, here I am. The second is, so glad you are, so glad you are, so glad you are. There is one last characteristic of the creatures that has not been explained on utilitarian grounds. The creatures seem to like to arrange themselves in striking patterns on the phosphorescent walls. Though blind and indifferent to anyone's watching, they often arrange themselves so as to present a regular and dazzling pattern of jonquil yellow and vivid aquamarine diamonds. The yellow comes from the bear cave walls. The aquamarine is the light of the walls filtered through the bodies of the creatures. Because of their love for music and their willingness to deploy themselves in the service of beauty, the creatures are given a lovely name by Earthlings. They are called Harmoniums. Unk and Boaz came in for a landing on the dark side of Mercury, 79 Earthling days out of Mars. They did not know that the planet on which they were landing was Mercury. They thought the sun was terrifyingly large, but that didn't keep them from thinking that they were landing on Earth. They blacked out during the period of sharp deceleration. Now they were regaining consciousness, were being treated to a cruel and lovely illusion. It seemed to Unk and Boaz that their ship was settling slowly among skyscrapers over which searchlights played.
"They aren't shooting," said Boaz. "Either the war's over or it ain't begun."
The merry beams of light they saw were not from searchlights. The beams came from tall crystals on the borderline between the light and dark hemispheres of Mercury. Those crystals were catching beams from the sun, were bending them prismatically, playing them over the dark side. Other crystals on the dark side caught the beams and passed them on. It was easy to believe that the searchlights were playing over a sophisticated civilization, indeed. It was easy to mistake the dense forest of giant blue-white crystals for skyscrapers, stupendous and beautiful. Unk, standing at a porthole, wept quietly. He was weeping for love, for family, for friendship, for truth, for civilization. The things he wept for were all abstractions, since his memory could furnish few faces or artifacts with which his imagination might fashion a passion play. Names rattled in his head like dry bones. Stony Stevenson, a friend. B, a wife. Chrono, a son. Unk, a father. The name Malachi Constant came to him, and he didn't know what to do with it. Unk lapsed into a blank reverie, a blank respect for the splendid people and the splendid lives that had produced the majestic buildings that the searchlight swept. Here, surely, faceless families and faceless friends and nameless hopes could flourish like... An apt image for flourishing eluded Unk. He imagined a remarkable fountain, a cone described by descending bowls of increasing diameters. It wouldn't do. The fountain was bone dry, filled with the ruins of birds' nests. Unk's fingertips tingled, as though abraded by a climb up the dry bowls. The image wouldn't do. Unk imagined again the three beautiful girls who had beckoned him to come down the oily bore of his Mauser rifle.
"Man," said Boaz, "everybody asleep. But not for long," he cooed, and his eyes flashed. "When old Boaz and old Unk hits this town," he said, "everybody going to wake up and stay woke up for weeks on end."
The ship was being controlled skillfully by its pilot navigator. The equipment was talking nervously to itself, cycling, whirring, clicking, buzzing. It was sensing and avoiding hazards to the sides, seeking an ideal landing place below. The designers of the pilot navigator had purposefully obsessed the equipment with one idea, and that idea was to seek shelter for the precious troops and materiel it was supposed to be carrying. The pilot navigator was to set the precious troops and materiel down in the deepest hole it could find. The assumption was that the landing would be in the face of hostile fire. 20 Earthling minutes later, the pilot navigator was still talking to itself, finding as much to talk about as ever. And the ship was still falling, and falling fast. The seeming searchlights and skyscrapers outside were no longer to be seen. There was only inky blackness. Inside the ship, there was silence of a hardly lighter shade. Unk and Boaz sensed what was happening to them, found what was happening unspeakable. They sensed correctly that they were being buried alive. The ship lurched suddenly, throwing Boaz and Unk to the floor. The violence brought violent relief.
"Home at last!" yelled Boaz. "Welcome home!"
Then the ghastly feeling of a leaf-like fall began again. 20 Earthling minutes later, the ship was still falling gently. Its lurches were more frequent. To protect themselves against the lurches, Boaz and Unk had gone to bed. They lay face down, their hands gripping the steel pipe supports of their bunks. To make their misery complete, the pilot navigator decreed that night should fall in the cabin. A grinding noise passed over the dome of the ship, forced Unk and Boaz to turn their eyes from their pillows to the portholes. There was a pale yellow light outside now. Unk and Boaz shouted for joy, ran to the portholes. They reached them just in time to be thrown to the floor again, as the ship freed itself from an obstruction, began its fall again. 1 Earthling minute later, the fall stopped. There was a modest click from the pilot navigator. Having delivered its cargo safely from Mars to Mercury, as instructed, it had shut itself off. It had delivered its cargo to the floor of a cave 116 miles below the surface of Mercury. It had threaded its way down through a torturous system of chimneys until it could go no deeper. Boaz was the first to reach a porthole, to look out and see the gay welcome of yellow and aquamarine diamonds the harmoniums had made on the walls.
"Unk," said Boaz, "God damn if it didn't go and set us down right in the middle of a Hollywood nightclub!"
A recapitulation of Schliemann breathing techniques is in order at this point, in order that what happened next can be fully understood. Unk and Boaz, in their pressurized cabin, had been getting their oxygen from goofballs in their small intestines. But, living in an atmosphere under pressure, there was no need for them to plug their ears and nostrils and keep their mouths shut tight. This sealing off was necessary only in a vacuum or in a poisonous atmosphere. Boaz was under the impression that outside the spaceship was the wholesome atmosphere of his native Earth. Actually, there was nothing out there but a vacuum. Boaz threw open both the inner and outer doors of the airlock with a grand carelessness predicated on a friendly atmosphere outside. He was rewarded with the explosion of the small atmosphere in the cabin into the vacuum outside. He slammed shut the inner door, but not before he and Unk had hemorrhaged in the act of shouting for joy. They collapsed, their respiratory systems bleeding profusely. All that saved them from death was a fully automatic emergency system that answered the explosion with another, bringing the pressure of the cabin up to normal again.
"Mama," said Boaz as he came to. "God damn, Mama! This sure as hell ain't Earth!"
Unk and Boaz did not panic. They restored their strength with food, rest, drink, and goofballs. And they then plugged their ears and nostrils, shut their mouths, and explored the neighborhood of the ship. They determined that their tomb was deep, torturous, endless, airless, uninhabited by anything remotely human, and uninhabitable by anything remotely human. They noted the presence of the harmoniums, but could find nothing encouraging in the presence of the creatures there. The creatures seemed ghastly. Unk and Boaz didn't really believe they were in such a place. Not believing it was the thing that saved them from panic. They returned to their ship.
"Okay," said Boaz calmly. "There has been some mistake. We have wound up too deep in the ground. We got to fly back on up to where them buildings are. I tell you frankly, Unc, it don't seem like to me this is even Earth we're in. There's been some mistake, like I say, and we got to ask the folks in the buildings where we are.
Okay, said Unc. He licked his lips.
Just push that old on button, said Boaz, and up we fly like a bird.
Okay, said Unc.
I mean, said Boaz, up there, the folks in the buildings may not even know about all this down here. Maybe we discovered something they'll be just amazed about.
Sure, said Unc. His soul felt the pressure of the miles of rock above, and his soul felt the true nature of their predicament. On all sides and overhead were passages that branched and branched and branched. And the branches forked to twigs, and the twigs forked to passages no larger than a human pore. Unc's soul was right in feeling that not one branch in 10,000 led all the way to the surface. The spaceship, thanks to the brilliantly conceived sensing gear on its bottom, had sensed its way easily down and down, through one of the very few ways in, down and down and down one of the very few ways out. What Unc's soul hadn't suspected yet was the congenital stupidity of the pilot navigator when it came to going up. It had never occurred to the designers that the ship might encounter problems going up. All Martian ships, after all, were meant to take off from an unobstructed field on Mars and to be abandoned after landing on Earth. Consequently, there was virtually no sensing equipment on the ship for hazards overhead.
So long, old cave, said Boaz.
Casually, Unc pressed the on button. The pilot navigator hummed. In 10 Earthling seconds, the pilot navigator was warm. The ship left the cave floor with whispering ease, touched a wall, dragged its rim up the wall with a grinding, tearing scream, bashed its dome on an overhead projection, backed off, bashed its dome again, backed off, grazed the projection, climbed whisperingly again. Then came the grinding scream again, this time from all sides. All upward motion had stopped. The ship was wedged in solid rock. The pilot navigator whimpered. It sent a wisp of mustard-colored smoke up through the floorboards of the cabin. The pilot navigator stopped whimpering. It had overheated, and overheating was a signal for the pilot navigator to extricate the ship from a hopeless mess. This it proceeded to do, grindingly. Steel members groaned. Rivets snapped like rifle shots. At last, the ship was free. The pilot navigator knew when it was licked. It flew the ship back down to the cave floor, landing with a kiss. The pilot navigator shut itself off. Unc pushed the on button again. Again, the ship blundered up into a blind passage, again retreated, again settled to the floor and shut itself off. The cycle was repeated a dozen times, until it was plain that the ship would only bash itself into pieces. Already, its frame was badly sprung. When the ship settled to the cave floor for the 12th time, Unc and Boaz went to pieces. They cried.
We're dead, Unc! We're dead! Said Boaz.
I've never been alive that I can remember, said Unc brokenly. I thought I was finally going to get some living done. Unc went to a porthole, looked out, with streaming eyes. He saw that the creatures nearest the porthole had outlined in aquamarine a perfect pale yellow letter T. The making of a T was well within the limits of probability for brainless creatures distributing themselves at random. But then Unc saw that the T was preceded by a perfect S. And the S was preceded by a perfect E. Unc moved his head to one side, looked through the porthole obliquely. The movement gave him a perspective down 100 yards of harmonium-infested wall. Unc was flabbergasted to see that the harmoniums were forming a message in dazzling letters. The message was this, in pale yellow, outlined in aquamarine. It's an intelligence test. Chapter 9 A Puzzle Solved.
In the beginning, God became the heaven and the earth, and God said, "Let me be light," and he was light.
The Winston Niles Rumford Authorized Revised Bible. For a delicious tea snack, try Young Harmoniums rolled into tubes and filled with Venusian cottage cheese. The Beatrice Rumford Galactic Cookbook.
In terms of their souls, the martyrs of Mars died not when they attacked Earth, but when they were recruited for the Martian war machine.
The Winston Niles Rumford Pocket History of Mars.
I found me a place where I can do good without doing any harm.
Boaz in Sarah Horn Canby's Unk and Boaz in the Caves of Mercury. The best-selling book in recent times has been the Winston Niles Rumford Authorized Revised Bible. Next in popularity is that delightful forgery, the Beatrice Rumford Galactic Cookbook. The third most popular is the Winston Niles Rumford Pocket History of Mars. The fourth most popular is a children's book, Unk and Boaz in the Caves of Mercury, by Sarah Horn Canby. The publisher's bland analysis of Mrs. Canby's book's success appears on the dust jacket. What child wouldn't like to be shipwrecked on a spaceship with a cargo of hamburgers, hot dogs, catsup, sporting goods, and soda pop? Dr. Frank Minot, in his Are Adults Harmoniums, sees something more sinister in the love children have for the book.
Dare we consider, he asks, how close Unk and Boaz are to the everyday experience of children when Unk and Boaz deal solemnly and respectfully with creatures that are, in fact, obscenely unmotivated, insensitive, and dull.
Minot,